Welcome to another episode of Blood, Sweat and Fears, the ultimate podcast for athletes, Olympians and sports people coping with the challenges of elite sport, both during and after their careers. And with this year being a huge summer of sport for women, including the Football World Cup, the Cricket Ashes and the Netball World Cup, we're handing over this edition of Blood, Sweat and Fears to the ladies. I'm Mark Clements. My co-host Scott Ward is a retired professional footballer who spent the last 10 years working in athlete welfare. This podcast is inspired by EY's personal performance program, which Scott heads. And regular listeners might remember we're following the transition away from her sport of Catherine Lane, who was recently cut from the GB hockey squad, but now has a role as part of Scott's team at EY as athlete program coordinator. She joins us, and Catherine's invited along some of her friends, Sophie Bray and Susanna Townsend. We're both part of Team GB's hockey's victorious gold medal winning team in 2016 in Rio and have amassed over 250 caps between them. And Rachel Morris is a triple medalist, two of them gold, across three consecutive Paralympics in three different disciplines. I'm going to start with you, Catherine. How are you getting on?
Yeah, really good, thank you.
Well, they'll judge this because they know you of old, obviously, yeah. These guys. What have you been up to? Where are you with your move into industry, enterprise, commerce?
So joined EY, I've been here 3 months now as part of Scott's team in the personal performance program. Yeah, really enjoying it. It's great to kind of help people avoid the pitfalls that we see can happen after sport.
Do you think your friends will be able to see a change in you? Have you become more corporate?
I don't know. After 3 months, yeah.
She dresses better.
It's quite hard to look good in a tracksuit.
Well, is it? Actually, because when we started this, we were having this debate because you're going through a similar process. Sophie, you started to work. And the first thing Susanna said was, you've got to learn to get dressed every morning.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if it's about learning to get dressed, but certainly the wardrobe, the trackies are out the wardrobe and slight new wardrobe, which is quite nice, actually. I've enjoyed a different wardrobe.
Yeah. I mean, that structure, has that been difficult to get it? In all seriousness, to suddenly have a 5 days a week structure, be putting 40, 50, probably 60 with Scott as your boss, hours in every week. Has that been challenging?
I don't think so. I think it's almost less structured than professional sport is. Like at work, as long as you get your work done, you can kind of do it in the way that you want to or where you want to within reason. Whereas professional sport, you have to be certain places, certain times, whenever. So that's kind of your whole life is structured, whereas at work, it's a lot less so.
And what have you been pleasantly surprised by for any sort of athletes out there thinking, oh gosh, you know, maybe I'm physically I'm starting to decline, I'm going to have to start thinking about working outside of sport. What have you enjoyed more than you were expecting? You're taking too long to answer this question.
I think for me, kind of that coming from a team sport, that very much in the business world, you're still working with a team, you're working with people. There's a huge amount of diversity in the office, and I've really enjoyed kind of working with a lot of new people from different backgrounds and interacting still, but working together as a team.
You see, Scott, this to me is a selling point of transition, which is that this is a recurring theme of these podcasts, that people can still find the same sort of team camaraderie in work scenarios.
I think a lot of it comes down to being fortunate and the culture that you're walking into as well. I think if they're accepting that you may not have that work experience or the pedigree in that environment that somebody sitting next to you may have, but those skill attributes that you can obviously then take over from sport into that sector. You have to be fairly fortunate, as I say. Obviously, Catherine's been very lucky in where she's managed to work and who her boss is. I think it's been a huge part of her success. But I must just say as well that her appetite and desire to be good at what she does is phenomenal, and she's a true inspiration for a lot of us. She really wants to help people, and I'm absolutely delighted that she's managed to join our team.
Well, she's feeling rather pleased now, isn't it? We'll just leave her to sort of let her the colour of her face
rushing.
Just decline a little bit. So, Donna, why you are not in employment at this point. So what's that all about? You're a similar age to Sophie.
Similar age. I've tried to sort of juggle a bit of work and simply, I mean, I've always found it very difficult to do both. I can't really explain why. I think it's just having two focuses that are so intense. I probably always struggled with in general anyway. I did do a bit of an internship a couple of months ago, and my mum said to me, because my hair's in a messy bun, and I showed her what I was going to wear that day, and she was like, Susanna, you can't have hair like that. And it made me really conscious and self-conscious, weirdly, of how I was. And actually within sport, I'm quite confident. I've been in the same environment for a very long time, and you feel quite comfortable. And actually stepping into another environment, like these two, like Sophie and Catherine have, I'm quite envious of that they found it almost so easy to do.
Are you nervous about it? Do you fret about it? Do you worry about yourself? Where are you going to end up in the future? What's going to happen to you?
Sophie and I have been roommates for years on tours, and we've had lots of conversations about it. And actually, Sophie's even been doing interviews whilst we've been on tours. And actually, we've spoken about, like, what do I end up doing? And when we were away once, I looked at charity work, I looked at loads of stuff, and I simply can't completely decide exactly what I want to do. And yeah, I am very anxious of it, because it's, at the moment, I'm loving hockey again. I went through a stage where I potentially wasn't loving it, but it got to a point where, and I'm being very open, I didn't really have a choice not to do it because I didn't have anywhere else to go. So it's
not to do the hockey.
Yeah, because it was that was my job, but I had nothing else to fall into. Whereas in comparison with Sophie was already doing a bit of work. She didn't just have the option of staying within hockey. She had two options, and I needed to find the reason as to make it a choice to stay. So I completely took myself away a little bit mentally, and instead of being forced to stay, it was a choice that I wanted to stay. So I'm not too apprehensive about what I will do. I mean, it may sound silly, but I seem to always fall on my feet somehow. So I do believe that if I find something, I'll pursue it. But at the moment, I haven't found something that grabs my attention.
Mm-hmm. I must say, that's quite a common trait where you do hear from, especially Olympians, that say, I don't necessarily want to do this cycle, but I have to. And a lot of it is obviously about earning potential and being given the opportunity to look over the wall. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, I can't speak from experience, but my colleagues, I've got multiple Olympians working with me, and it just seems to be a real shame that you're not given that opportunity to scope or to try and clarify what it can look beyond that cycle, knowing that it's not going to be detrimental towards that competitive end of those 4 years. Mm.
Rachel, I mean, welcome. I mean, you've been involved in three cycles. Is it quite immersive? Does it sort of wrap you in and hook you in? And when you come off the back of a big tournament, we always hear about this sort of post-Paralympics, post-Olympic crashed, yeah, coming back down. You kind of get yourself through that, and the taste is there to want it again?
Yeah, I think that... for me, I've really noticed a difference as well, transferring in different sports, just how different sports look at it, which sounds really silly. And one of the things when I first transferred was that I took it, and I was told very much that because it was all run under UK Sport, therefore the programmes were running in the same way.
Just explain where you went from and to, just sorry, with this, yeah, movement, so, about the sport. So you started out with...
So I was at British Cycling.
Yeah.
And that was from... So Beijing and London.
Yeah.
And then 2013, I left and went to British Rowing, or okay, GB Rowing. And then I've done that. And then I've had a bit of a break and had some massive surgery on my shoulders, and then come back, and I've now gone into Nordic ski, which, yeah, is obviously now on the winter cycle. So I've really noticed that. And again, that's the other odd thing, is that I've gone into the winter cycle now, and so I've just had my 3 weeks off, and I can't get my head around the fact that it's nice weather, and now I'm training and doing the groundwork now rather than doing it over the winter. So it is very different. Mm. And very now, different approaches.
I mean, obviously you do have a very unique set of circumstances. You've just shown this remarkable courage and dedication to your sport. Do you mind sharing the outline of your story with us, please?
I don't know, that's a very nice way of putting it, but I think that I was a runner before. So when I had my legs until I was sort of 19, and then I had the other one amputated about 2 years later. But I, at the beginning, I was a runner, and that's all I wanted to do. So I wanted to be an Olympic runner. I had that dream, I guess, from the age of about 13. And then Roger Black came and did a talk at school, which is also now why I am quite passionate about going back into schools, because I do know that it has, it's like I'm sure you got what say as well, that it does have a big impact on people for lots of different reasons, not necessarily taking them into sport, but making them have that dream, maybe whatever it is, and getting them, there's a couple of schools working at the moment who are quite deprived and struggling, and it's about going in and giving them just a dream. It doesn't have to be a sporting dream, but it's about, they see a shiny medal, so it's about giving them that sort of medal magic, as I call it, and then it kind of, you know, hopefully it inspires them, or it at least gives them that sort of feeling that they want something.
I'm just going to stop you there for a second. Is that how you told me your medal had semi run out? And is that because you kept taking it into schools and kids kept touching it and rubbing it?
Yeah, so some people don't allow this. I don't know if you do, but I let everyone wear it. Let the kids pass it around, because it's, and some athletes don't because they're very precious about it. But for me, it's,
do you see it as your precious asset, or do you see it as an asset of the nation?
I've never thought about it that way, but probably more, I don't specifically think of it as mine, actually, yeah. But I've never, that's actually made me think. But I don't know, when you see a kid literally put it around their neck or hold it and you see their eyes light up, that's what especially means a lot more to me now than it ever did, especially with any other medal, because for an Olympic medal, it's the one thing everyone wants, really. And to see these kids wear it and how happy they get. And if it does inspire one child, then that's almost enough. You're not going to inspire everyone potentially, but one or two, that's all we sort of set out to do. So, yeah.
Does it continue to inspire you as athletes that you can look down at this achievement and know you topped the world, and you can, when you are struggling with health issues as you have, it can inspire you to know you can get through adversity and go again?
I think there's two ways. I think if you've got at the point and you're, or it went up for me when I was in a, if you like, positive mental attitude, then I could look at it in that way. But once I'd lost, so come out of Rio and then gone very quickly and had surgery, and suddenly I couldn't even sit up on my own, I couldn't do anything, I couldn't get out of bed unless I was being hoisted into my chair. It was the most demoralizing time, and that actually made it harder, because I was then looking at something and going, I'm so far from this, and now, like, I was literally kind of on top of the world, and now I can't even do this on my own. So I think it can have two ways of having an effect on you as a or for me as a person, but going forwards now, yeah, absolutely. Going into a different sport, going into a different structure, a very military structure, and no females, it's been quite a different challenge. So yeah, I do have to look at it sometimes and go, oh my god, I really need to want this.
Do you mind if I go back to sort of you having surgery when you got back, so I can relate to it a little bit, because I had a bad cartilage going into the Olympics, so we knew it was bad, and that I'd have to have an operation when we got back. And that's why I probably look at that medal in quite a different way, because within 3 weeks of getting back, I was non-weight bearing for two and a half months.
Yeah.
And actually, at that point in my career, in my life, it suddenly became, all I want to do is, well, one, be able to walk normally, two, actually be able to play hockey. And it's, that medal meant the world to me, but not actually the medal itself. And it was the people I experienced it with. But all I wanted was simply to go back and to do something again with my friends, whether that was the whole 4-year cycle or to win another medal. And it put a lot of things into perspective for me, because it made me reassess why I wanted to be there and why I wanted to do it. And yes, the ultimate goal is to win medals, but actually it made me realize that the reason I do it is to be with my friends and have a good time and play a sport that I love. So it's quite a weird place to be in, because you're very dependent on outside factors and other people, and but it makes you realise quite a lot, I think.
Sorry, forgive me. This was the 2016 medal, and you knew you were going to surgery off the back of it. You were carrying something through the tournament.
So about a month and a half before, Sophie will probably laugh at the memory, but my knee felt a bit weird, and I thought absolutely nothing of it because I'd literally had no injuries. Yeah. So I didn't even tell anyone for a couple of weeks, because everyone was like, well, I said it was a bit sore. They were like, foam roll your quads, towel. And I was like, give that a go. And then I went in, and my knee was really swollen. And I still didn't think anything of it. Went for a squat scan quite quickly. Came back, and they said, look, you need an operation. And you will need an operation, but we can inject it, and you'll get through the Olympics, and you'll make it a lot worse. Or you have an operation now, and you don't go. So obviously, I had the injection, made it a lot worse. forgot about it for a bit, and then it came back straight away. So it was something that I realised quite quickly, but in terms of living off the medal as such, it almost got to the point where I didn't really want to, because I couldn't say yes to events, I was on crutches, life became very hard very quickly. But actually, it's probably one of the most valuable things I've weirdly ever been through, because I learned so much about myself.
I think this comes back to the point of relativity. So, you know, here we're talking about some really disparate experiences and challenges in life, and everyone has their own point of challenge. And I think this is what isn't necessarily highlighted in sport, that, you know, it could be a cartilage, it could be the fact that you may not be able to lift yourself out of bed, or it might be that you're not going to go through the next cycle. We try and tarnish everyone with the same challenges and the same brush in terms of how they need to interpret the world, and that's just not how life is. And I think just by extending our levels of communication and allowing athletes to speak openly about these things, it will allow us to be better and to do better. But at times I just feel like it can be quite a stifling environment.
And you know, in that private chamber that you two shared, because you were roomies in 2016, mm-hmm. you saw a very different side to the public, Susanna Townsend. She was obviously sharing those anxieties.
Yeah, definitely. As roommates, kind of you see each other at our best. I've seen Tanner at her best, at her worst. You know, it's your roommate is a, you confide in them about the difficulties, about the anxieties. And it's a massive kind of support you have as you go through the year, through the tournaments, the ups and downs leading into Olympics, and then obviously during the 2 weeks at the Olympics, kind of knowing that you've got that support and that person that you can reach out to no matter what I found so important when it was such an important part of how I kind of managed elite sport.
And that it's got to be a huge low when you have been not just part of the camaraderie of a squad, not just winning a gold medal, but also inextricably intertwined with somebody, like you're with somebody virtually 24/7, sharing that experience, to then go home and find you've got to pop to get a pint of milk from Tesco Express. It must bring you down to earth with a short, sharp bang.
Yeah, definitely. You know, since I have retired, you miss your teammates. Obviously, there's the changing room, which I think all sports people know is an incredibly special place, and you certainly miss the changing room, but it's also your mates that, you know, I've played with some of them since I was 15, 16, growing up together. I think we forget kind of how old we're getting, because time kind of just stands still as we just grow up together. And I definitely kind of miss seeing them every day, for sure.
Do you in any way, I don't want this to turn into a sob story, but you got so close to these guys that achieved the top of the world, and then obviously there have been these changes to the selection criteria with Team GB hockey, etc. Do you ever think about that, just how close you came to the big prize?
Not really, because I don't know if I ever would have got to that big prize. I don't know if I would have ever been good enough to get there.
Did you decide that, or did somebody tell you that?
Probably someone told me that. Probably told that.
You don't. So it doesn't play on you. You've firmly parked it and are happy to embark on this separate career and are no longer an international hockey player.
Yeah, it's quite interesting, because actually this week, so I've just transferred offices to a different location. And previously, when I first started at EY, I would introduce myself as ex-hockey player transitioning into EY. Yeah. And this last week, I've been introducing myself as part of the personal performance program, and hockey player hasn't even crossed my mind.
Yeah.
So that change of identity, and I've read, like, for my dissertation, I'm studying it, I read so much about it, Scott talks about it all the time. But suddenly now I'm living it, and you actually kind of understand the experience so much more.
Because we've both got football pals. You know, I've got Danny Mills, Danny Higginbottom, don't refer to themselves as footballers anymore. They refer to themselves as property owners or commentators or whatever it is. And it's an important distinction to get onto the next phase of your life.
Yeah, I mean, it's linked, obviously linked to that happy medium, isn't it? I think a lot of athletes that come out of sport are always thinking about that social status element. So. And again, it's difficult if it's attached to your earning potential. Clearly, you're going to hang on to that label for as long as you can, because that's how you're going to get paid. I think, you know, for Catherine specifically, she's in an environment of a team where we've all been through it. Obviously, I'm a lot older than Catherine, so I've been through it a lot longer than she has. But I think being allowed to be open and having some real honest conversation around the fact that you may come in today and not feel very good, it's fine. Instead of having to feel like you've got to wear that persona when you come in and be the brave one, it's nonsense. And as I said, it doesn't matter how long you play sport for. When you're a kid, you start sport to be the best. Or to, for example, if you're going to play soccer, you want to play at Wembley. That's the aspiration. You want to play for your country. And so, again, we shouldn't give that type of social scale to whether you win a gold medal or you've competed. You try to do your best. And so that should be respected. And people should be given the same opportunities based on that, not, as I said, based upon whether you've played in the Premier League or you've competed for your country.
Did you use it in any way to engineer your job, your internship, did it come up during interview? Do you use it now to introduce yourself to people?
I would say the opportunity came about through my hockey network. So through someone I knew through hockey. He put me in touch with the internship opportunity. But I quite like kind of going into the workplace and that identity not being associated with hockey. And for me, it's easier to do because I work in technology, so nothing really to do with sport. It's a completely different world, so I don't really have to refer anything back to my sport.
Does anybody ever discover by accident, and there's a little bit of a kind of Chinese, you know, she is, don't you? She was one. Do you remember they all piled on top of each other when they've got the gold medal? And, you know,
yeah, one or two people have admitted that, you know, I think they probably looked up on LinkedIn or something, and then they admitted that they did a bit of stalking and found my background, and they were.
But
they were like, oh my gosh,
we
didn't know.
You'd be used to that
know.
With having roomed with Susanna
well, exactly.
all those years and things, yeah.
And the other occasion, there's a table tennis table at work and tend to play about 10 minutes a day. And that is a skill I have developed. My table tennis has got pretty good. And someone in the workplace was watching and they were like, it's as if you're training for the Olympics. And you kind of just have to chuckle inside. But yeah, you don't know how many people do know my background in the workplace. Obviously, you know, your manager will and the team kind of know your background. There's always the dilemma of sometimes when you introduce yourself to people, you know, I'm on an internship, and then they'll say, oh, so, you know, when did you graduate? What are you studying at the moment? And it's kind of like, do you bring up the fact that you've actually been in elite sport for 6 years, or do you kind of just kind of say, yeah, I've come out of, you know, my master's and now I'm into work.
Have you found a difference when they find out that you used to be an athlete in terms of how they communicate with you?
I don't know. I think what's been nice is you do get a lot of respect. You know, people kind of are really impressed. But I think they also... And what I like is that they just treat you kind of as any other employee, really. And that's what I want to be treated as.
I think it's the sort of cult of the modern day, isn't it? Because there is an incredible story in the early 70s when Sir Geoff Hurst, the only man to ever score a hat-trick in the World Cup final, was working as an insurance salesman. And he went into this one garage and gave his card to the receptionist. And the guy that owned the garage came back out, threw it on the desk in front of him and said, "We don't deal with former footballers. Can you leave my garage, please?" And threw him out. It just goes to show how things go full cycle and turn around.
It really does. And it's funny because we've spoken on previous podcasts around that association.
Have I told that story before?
No, not that specific story. It's probably one of the few that you haven't repeated, Clem. But there's been occasions where, you know, you choose... Like you say, you choose not to tell somebody where you've come from. And I think when you've been a footballer, there is that tarnish that comes out very quickly, as opposed to being a rugby player, for example, or a hockey player. And
I don't know why the hockey players don't have that reputation. Can you imagine these guys? The night they won the gold medal.
I'm not privy to the stories. So,
no, I'm not. I don't need to. I just need to look at their faces.
I think, again, that comes back to that social standing element. Are we willing to let people succeed based upon how we find them and what they can offer us at that given time? Or are we basing it upon retrospective view? And that's, again, that's a highly damaging thing to have. again, just goes back to my point around preparation and allowing an individual to have individual aspirations aside from being athletes. Mm. And we can do, the sooner we can do that, it'll be for the betterment of sport and for the betterment of them. And who doesn't want to see somebody be successful?
Mm. If you're hearing a little bit of jingling, jangling, it's because Rachel's brought her dog Whisper. It's not Scott's motorcycle boots, the buckles jingling away. I don't want to be too mawkish and tell me to go away if I'm overly prying, but your life turned on a moment. You twisted an ankle on a dry ski slope and led to a series
the most stupid thing.
A series, yeah. But I mean, I'm trying to imagine the mental fortitude you've had to show and the fact that your life is governed by pain and has been ever since.
I think that, I don't know whether I'd been as I am had I not had sport. I think that's when sport can be really good in the sense that it gave me the ability, I guess, to come back from things because I could set goals. I could understand that I had to carry it through to get to the next stage. I think that I had enough of that.
Which included your double amputations, because as a result of the accident, you were in chronic pain and there was no way out of it without.
It wasn't
the amputations.
So I ended up with sepsis, so I had blood poisoning, which is why I had the amputations. Ah. It wasn't for the pain, that happens, but for right or wrong, that wasn't for me. Mine was because of infection.
But the way you are driven now and the courage of you shown, that is to produce endorphins that give you relief?
Yeah, it makes a massive difference for me. I kind of see it as a bit like buying myself some time. So if I'm doing something that starts at 9 o'clock or whatever, then I'll get up at 4 o'clock to train for a couple of hours so that I get myself a window where I can think without it being affected by my legs hurting so much. But it's a way I've just found of doing it, and I guess it's the same as somebody else, I don't know, taking a tablet. I've just found that that's how, and that's the best way for me to make it better.
Is there an emotional draw to it as well? It's a loaded question because I met an ex-Marine last week who'd managed to survive 3 tours of duty in Afghanistan and then sadly lost one of his legs helping a road traffic accident on the M3. He's since rode the Atlantic twice. Is it the same with your sports, your pursuits, that you want something to aim for? It gives you something on the horizon to lock into, to drive you forward?
It does. I think there is a big part of it to do with that, actually. I think there is. I don't quite know how to explain it, but if it doesn't make sense, that's fine. But I think that having the sort of label or the image, whatever, of being a wheelchair user, of having a, in brackets, disability, I think that for me, if I'm as an athlete, then I don't have that label attached to me anywhere near as much. Mm-hmm. And for me, it's really important to get away from having to, right, you can only work with children in wheelchairs because you're in a chair. Well, why? Because I had my legs before. I'm still the same person at the top. And, you know, if I set to have an interview with somebody or I'm doing something and I'm sat in the room behind the table already, they don't know that I'm in a chair. And then suddenly they see me in a chair, they change their attitude. And so I think as an athlete, particularly the way the Paralympics has changed and over the last few, I've been lucky coming into it from 2008 onwards, it sort of really came up from that point. But I think that it does take away the label for me of the way that people, I still get judgment, but I think it probably makes me feel a bit stronger about everything.
Mm. And so going back to taking the medal into the schools, it's a similar principle. You're trying to move perceptions as part of the process.
I think that's one of the biggest things I could say that came, if that's what comes out of my medal, in the sense of getting children who have got a label attached to them, special needs, whether it's mental health, whether it's physical hidden disabilities, whatever it is that they struggle with, but getting them to understand that they are valued and should be valued in the same way, and they will find a talent, they will find something they can do that actually they get a lot of enjoyment from and that they are worthwhile and they're putting back into their community with, then yeah, if my medal gets rubbed away to a 2p coin at the end of it, I'd be really happy, because hopefully that's then dripped out enough medal magic to kind of change people's ideas and things. Yeah.
Bearing in mind what you've been through, bearing in mind what you've put yourself through. How do you manage your downtime and your mental health?
So anybody that is in camp or training camp with me or anywhere, like, no, they my biggest thing is stopping and sitting, because it exacerbates my legs. So then I sort of perhaps I'm on the go a bit more than maybe I should be, which is probably why I didn't live very near Bisham, so that when I went home I could carry on doing stuff and nobody ever knew what I was doing. Mm-hmm. And so I think that, yeah, I do, that's probably my biggest, it's my weakness as an athlete, it's my biggest flaw, because, you know, scientifically I can tell you the benefits of rest and the, you know, rehab, recoup stuff, absolutely, but it just isn't something that I'm very good at. I am trying, as I've grown up a little bit, I'm trying to do it.
I also say that Rachel puts a lot of great tweets out about Whisper, her dog, who carries about 12-foot branches in her mouth while Rachel is out training with her.
She's a bit of a treeaholic, I think. She literally does carry stuff, and I was saying to you earlier, she makes people actually, like, she'll walk up to them in the path and make them step over the twig rather, or the log, rather than actually going around them.
Now, Catherine, when we were planning this podcast, we discussing gender equality, and you've got some stats there, and they are horrendous for 2019.
Yeah, so just linking into Rachel and Susanna's and Sophie's point about kind of going into schools and showing off their medals. So females 14 years old, only 10% of the population of female 14-year-olds do the required amount of exercise per week.
Do we know why?
Well, there's not reasons in the report, but I reckon these guys could throw out a few.
Well, go on then.
People just don't... There is still this image for girls, particularly around... And it's Mental Health Week and body image at the moment, but there is a big thing about girls. You know, if you become physically fit, particularly at that age, going into your teens, and you've got muscle, then that gets judged and people look at you in that way, get teased. I think that's definitely a reason along those. I'm sure there are loads of others as well.
Well, as a youngster, you almost have to go against the crowd a little bit. That's how I felt at school. So it was, yeah, you're the girl kicking a ball with the boys at break time. It's, you're not doing the stereotypical, which is wrong in my opinion, that the girl thing, and it's very different, and it's, you have to be quite strong, have a strong character to be able to do it, and it's almost saying no to a lot of other things and almost following what you want to do, and that's why I find, especially a lot of, well, every female sports person, or not even just sports person, you have to be very strong-willed to be able to survive in this world, because you have to sometimes, a lot of the time I felt, as you go against the norm, which it shouldn't be that way, but that's just how society is probably still.
Is there not a groundswell with these big events, though, coming up this year? I mean, yeah, particularly female football. I mean, this is going to be huge this summer.
Yeah, it's going to be massive. Have you seen the Germany women's video this morning?
No.
So it's this big campaign around their team, and it's all about... So the strap line is, we don't have balls, but we know how to use them. And it's all stuff like, we're representing a nation of people that don't know our names. They've won the European Championships 8 times and still people don't know their names. If the England men's football team had done that, they'd probably have knighthoods. It's ridiculous. So stat here, 7% of women's sport takes up media coverage in the UK.
That feels to me as though it is changing, though, and has changed quite drastically in the last couple of years. You're nodding, Sophie, thus not hanging me out to dry and leaving me on my own there.
No, I definitely think it has. I think there's an awful long way to go. And those stats that Catherine's just spoken about show it. But I do think, kind of when I try and think back to a few years ago, growing up as well as a kid, playing sport, I was very fortunate that I had, you know, two great role models growing up. Kay Richardson Walsh, I used to remember going down to Surbiton training as a kid and seeing her doing the extra running sessions, and you know, she would take some of our sessions as well and engage in the youth section. And then also, while I was playing football, Rachel Yankee. She was playing for the Fulham ladies team back then, and you know, I was growing up wanting to be her. So I think what's fantastic is that there are so many role models in women's sport, and you know, that's
Well, you say that, but if we look at some other stats, sorry to interrupt yourself, but if we look at some other stats there, the Forbes 100 top sports people in the world for 2018, there isn't a woman in there.
No, it was the highest earners.
Highest earners, yeah, sorry.
Highest earners. So there was no one in there. 2017, Serena Williams was the only one that made it.
Yeah, but a highest earner doesn't need to make you a role model.
No, no, right. You are right.
So. I think that's one of the challenges. So I've got two daughters who are 6 and 10, Isabella and Phoebe. And if I look at the level of appreciation for participation for girls in sport, it's just not the same. So I'm one of four boys. We all played football. It's a given you're going to play football since the first day that you can walk. And yet we don't have that level of inspiration or desire to allow girls to do the same. So more recently, my wife and I have been taking them to watch Wasps netball. And I must say, I love netball. It's one of the fastest sports I've seen, and it gets quite aggy at times. So I really enjoy that side of it. But to see my girl's face when they watch it and how they get gooey-eyed when they meet the ladies after the match, because they actually want to meet the fans. And I think a lot of this comes down to that social and cultural influence and desire from those within sport to have closer levels of communication with the fans. I look at what Olympians do and I think it's phenomenal. But there's not the level of finance attached to that industry, whereas you look at football where the money is monumental, you don't get the same desire. And I think, again, that is a cultural influence that needs to be changed. The unfortunate thing is, going back to these stats, is that stats don't change overnight, and it can take up to a decade for you to see a long-term change in anything you do.
But in the modern world, where we've got, say, a couple of the Nevilles at the forefront of women's sport, i.e. Phil leading the England football team and Tracy's sister leading the netball team, high profile figureheads can make a huge amount of difference.
Absolutely.
They'll attract extra column inches. It's a barren sport from a male point of view this summer in terms of a big tournament. I think I'm right in saying, aren't I? Is there anything else I should be aware of? Is there anything happening? There's nothing too much that comes to mind.
No.
So, there are going to be a lot of male fans or fans of the male football game that are going to sit down and watch those matches. And it doesn't take long for a residual build to start to move.
No, but I think that one of the difficulties that is current is that when, for example, Roger Black was outperforming everybody and winning medals, you didn't have that social element of sharing communications. You didn't have the internet where you could watch different sports. And so when people came to see you, you were really touched by that, because that was one of your few opportunities to be speaking to them or to have direct dialogue. Now I think that because there are so many sports and so many contact points, that you've locked that, I feel like we've lost that emotional connection point between aspiring athletes and athletes themselves. And again, I think the Olympian cycle is different and the Paralympic cycle is different, because for you to be a Paralympian or an Olympian, you really want to be that person, because again, you're not getting the financial rewards that you do for being a footballer. So I think, again, it comes back to motivation and cultural acceptance of why you're doing it. Hearing the women speak here about their medal and why they've won their medal, I would challenge that you'd hear those same types of comments from somebody when you say, why do you want to be a footballer? Again, it's your point of desire and your motivation. And that's why I think female sport has the biggest point of influence right now, because it is evolving rapidly. We need to do so much more, and I mean a hell of a lot more in this space. But in terms of point of influence, I really feel like they have the biggest opportunity to change the way and the mindset of us as a society moving forward.
I think we will always compare, and I think for a long time the differences between men's and women's sport will be quite significant in terms of media coverage, in terms of financial earnings. I think at the same time it's also though important to look where women's sport has come from as well. I think I remember my dad took me to the women's FA Cup final, which was at Craven Cottage, and there'd be a couple of thousand people there. And you look at it now, 15 years on, and you've got 40 odd thousand at Wembley,
I think governing bodies have been, like, for example, football, putting the money into the club system. You look at rugby, yes, the England women got their money taken away post their last World Cup, but at the time as a player it would have been difficult for them, but actually they then put money into their league again. So although, yes, it may not be, like I sort of said, overnight, happening overnight, I think they are trying to change things to obviously get it out there that people know the sports, that athletes do earn enough money. And to make, you don't forget, a lot of rugby players still, women's rugby players aren't professional. They've still got jobs, they're still playing for their country, they're still on camps. It's tough. And being hockey players, we've been quite fortunate to be in an era where we have been able to earn money. It's still not completely, in my opinion, where it should be. And you'll hear a lot of athletes say that we're very fortunate to have the funding. We are very fortunate to have the funding. But at the same time, we won a lot of things. We are the best there is sort of in our sports at this time. And you look at the sort of the proportion on sponsorship money that men still earn. I can give you an example, and I won't sort of name any names, but I had a sponsorship package with my previous sponsor, and there was a male player, male counterpart, and hadn't won an Olympic medal at the time, hadn't won a medal, was earning double. And I argued it, my social media presence was bigger, they still couldn't offer me the same. But on paper, I was, regardless whether it was female or male, on paper, I was more valuable. And I think at the moment, we still have a long way to go in terms of that, because we're still edging towards supporting males more. And from personal experience, that's where I get a bit annoyed. But I think...
You get a bit annoyed, but or a lot. I mean, how much of that is a talking point? When you two went and locked yourselves away in your room, how much is this discussed in women's sport, this huge disparity? Does it affect your motivation? Are you deeply resentful about it? Do you have to accept it and get on with ploughing your own furrow? What discussion is there about it?
I think it's a combination of, obviously, you know, a level of self-interest. We play sport for a living. So, you know, with any job, you know, people want financially to earn as much as they, you know, think they deserve and can. But I also think it is a combination of, we want to put the jersey in a better place for those people coming through. So for the girls currently at school, we want to kind of leave the shirt in a better place. And so we do feel passionate about speaking up and kind of making a point. So hopefully these changes can happen and the youngsters coming through will have more opportunities, just like the women that went ahead of us that gave us this opportunity. We feel the same, that we want to do that to the future talent coming through.
To give you an idea about Sophie and I, that we didn't probably discuss it a lot, really, because when we used to leave our room before a game, you think it'd be all this serious chat, but we'd look at each other and just say, oh, let's just go and have a good time and bring home 3 points, and then we'll come back and lay on our beds. That was pretty much our chat. It was very down to earth. And I think what Catherine, Sophie and I, especially in hockey, and probably the same with you, but we simply played because we love it. Mm-hmm. I don't think, for me, especially growing up, it was ever the forefront of my mind that I'd be earning money from playing it. And actually thinking of it in that respect, I'm very fortunate. I think we all are to have been able to play a sport we love and earn some money from it, but it's certainly not the reason we play. And I would hope that it would never get to that point, because as has been mentioned with sort of football, male football especially, you don't want it to ever be the reason that you play, or to be happy sitting on a bench or just picking up your pay packet. And none of us have actually ever been in that situation, because we play because we love the sports that we play.
I think that is part, that, well, that's the main driver for people. That they, you can say that about everyone sat here, is that you are driven by the fact that you love your sport and that you're putting something back in, and that, you know, you see the other people or the next lot that are coming through to training, whether it's through schools or whether it's through clubs and grassroots. It's about those, you know, the fact that they come in and they are really excited about it. They go into change rooms and you can hear them like just messing around, and it's that really nice sort of, they're starting to learn about teamwork, they're starting to learn about things that schools really struggle to put in now, a bit like resilience, things like that. That I think, you know, sports lessons are so small anyway that they're losing that. And so that, I think, is one of the big roles that we've had, hopefully, and I hope that carries on, is that what we're putting back into it is those sort of values that they then take away and we'll put in, and they'll grow on it through for the next group.
You've been very selfless with a couple of those answers there, but don't ever forget the contribution you made and the satisfaction you gave and the happiness you created through winning those medals and, you know, those achievements that you had. So you deserve to be remunerated for that. That's it for another episode of Blood, Sweat and Fears. Thank you for listening. We've got a huge range of athletes, sports people and indeed sports coming up in future episodes. So do please keep an ear out. For more information about the podcast, please visit our website, ey.com/UK/personal-performance-program. This podcast and future podcasts in the Blood, Sweat and Fears range are on iTunes and via the EY website by visiting ey.com/UK/PAS/podcast. Thanks and good luck for the future to Rachel Morris, to Sophie Bray, to Susanna Townsend, and of course to our transitioning regular, Catherine Lane, who still hasn't played. Still hasn't played the ukulele for us that she promised in episode one. Yeah, your friends are a little bit surprised.
I was in a bad place.
You are doing it at some point in the future. Great to see you, Scott. I'm Mark Clement, brought to you by EY, Building a Better Working World. Thanks for listening to the latest episode of Blood, Sweat and Fears, the ultimate podcast with a focus on athlete experiences, readiness and preparation for life in and out of sport. Goodbye.